All right. So recap.
Just real quick.
The introduction concerned, of course, the Apostle Paul and his apostleship. That included the obedience to the faith. We talked about those things. Then that next section was really about his relationship with the Romans, which was not much other than they were Christians and thus fellow members of the household of God. He didn't know them personally. He had never been to visit them, but he wanted to. And he wanted to be encouraged by their faith and then be encouraged by his faith. And he was set out to preach the gospel to the Gentiles as the apostle appointed to the Gentiles, Peter to the circumcision, as we read in Galatians 2. And Rome would include that, but Rome was already established. We saw in Romans 15 that he wanted to preach where Christ hadn't been preached. And since he had accomplished that, there wasn't any place left in his realm of teaching and where he wanted to go where Christ hadn't been taught. He now wants to come to Rome. Of course, we know that he'll never get to do that because when he does find himself in Rome, he's in captivity under house arrest at the end of Acts. But he wants to come. And that sets out his theme. He wants to come to preach. And he wants to come to preach the gospel. Now, the gospel, we noted, of course, is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. And the reason for it being that power is because in it, God's righteousness is revealed from faith to faith. We discussed that that's the object of faith that produces our subject of faith. Romans 10:17, faith comes by hearing the word of God. And it's not the righteousness of God in the sense that he is righteous, but how we are by his will to be righteous before him. Now that's where we get to verse 18. So all of that, of course, is important to remember because verse 18 starts setting out the reason for God making this plan that men can become righteous. And there would be no plan that was needed if men were already righteous. They wouldn't need to become righteous. So that's why we make the argument that infant baptism is unscriptural, because God talks about how children are innocent. Jesus said, of such is the kingdom of heaven. They're without sin. There was a time, we actually see in Romans 7, Paul says that he was alive once without the law, and that was when he wasn't held accountable to the law as a child. As children do not know right from wrong, they don't make the decisions for themselves. They are free from that, and thus they're free from sin. And so there's a time when we're without sin, and so we don't need to be made righteous, because that's what it is. If we're without sin, we are righteous. We're just before God. And so the whole reason for this will of God, this plan of God, the righteousness of God being revealed in the gospel is because we are unrighteous. Not we now as Christians. If we're unrighteous before God now, that means sin is in our life and we're not right with him. We don't have the hope that he's given to us, so we need to make that right. 1 John 1 says, we go to him and confess our sins, and he's faithful and just to forgive us of our sins. And so let's understand that. When Paul writes in Romans 7 about him being a wretched man that I am, he's not talking about himself as a Christian. He's talking about himself before Christ, making that point. And so we need to understand that. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That's why the gospel needs to be given to us and the way we become righteous before God. But that doesn't mean that we as Christians are still unrighteous. If we're in sin, certainly, but we're to be right before God, and he gives us the tools to be right before him at all times. And when we do fall short, one of the tools he gives us is that forgiveness through prayer. But he points out, as he noted in chapter 1 and verse 16, that it's the gospel is the power of God to salvation for the Jew first and also for the Greek. He's going to emphasize that in these first three chapters. Starting with verse 18, he's going to show the Gentiles are in sin. And we can understand it as the Gentiles who are in sin, because when we get to chapter 2, he says, therefore, in verse 1, you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are to judge. And we jump down to verse 8 or verse 9, and he says that there's tribulation and anguish on every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first and also of the Greek. Verse 11, there's no partiality with God. And then verse 12 really picks up, emphasizing that you're a Jew, you're without excuse, you have the law, and yet you are just as guilty as the Gentiles. And so there's ample evidence that he is showing that the Gentiles and the Jews both are under sin, and he starts especially with the Gentiles. So that's the reason, and that's what we're talking about, the reason why the gospel of Christ needed to be revealed. Notice he says in verse 16, for it is the power of God to salvation. And then he says in verse 18, for the wrath of God. And so when we see that for, it's a because of type of a thing, explanatory. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Why aren't you ashamed? Because that's how God saves us. Well, why is that how God saves us? Why was that even necessary? Because the wrath of God is revealed. And so we see that. We see what it's who it's revealed against. We read what they did to be those who are subjects of God's wrath. And then really what we see is what is picking up in chapter 1 is part of what God's wrath is that is revealed. If people want to sin, God's going to show them how ugly that sin is by letting them, in their free will, progress in sin. And that's part of God's wrath. But we need to understand it. And so really the first question tonight will be of that lesson number 2, I guess it is. And we'll just start off with it, because he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now, the thought question is this. Why does God, in parentheses, who is love, from 1 John 4:8, we know God is love. Why does God, who is love, also have wrath? That's very important as we progress through this book of Romans. How do we reconcile that? God is love, but the wrath of God is revealed against men.
Logan. Wrath is love.
What is that?
Wrath is love.
Okay. Do you care to expound on that?
Without the wrath, where's the care?
Okay. Yeah. If sin is left unchecked, which is what the wrath of God is, showing how ugly sin is, God, because He is pure, needs to demonstrate that purity and holiness by showing His aversion toward sin, right? And so in a way, when we see God's wrath, we see that He doesn't like that and that will be punished, and we're moved toward the gospel to obey it, right? I think that's a very good point, one that I didn't make in my notes, and it really does drive home that point of, a lot of people will say, I don't believe God exists, because if God is a God of love, then why are all these bad things happening? Well, God wouldn't be so loving if He just let us sin without consequence when that sin separated us from Him and there was no warning about the eternal wrath to come, right? That's a good point. What else? How would we reconcile that?
Well, at Genesis, when Adam and Eve disobeyed God, that transgression, they were cast out.
Mm-hmm.
They're separated from God.
Right.
That'd be the same thing with us. If we're a child of God and we sin and continue in sin, we're severed that relationship.
Okay. Well, isn't that unloving that He cast them out?
No, because sin can't stand for Him love.
Okay. And that's why the question is the thought question. We're trying to reconcile that God is love, but He displays wrath. And so the display of wrath was when they were cast out of the garden. But if God is love, why wouldn't He let them stay in the garden? You know, just you sin, okay, I understand that, but I love you enough to let you stay. Why? Let me phrase it this way. He had to expel them. There had to be vengeance, a wrath that is outpoured. And why? If He's love, why do He have to do that?
Just like in that instance, God loved them enough to let them stay, but He loved them even more to keep them out.
Okay, yeah.
Just like when we teach our kids not to do something, they repeatedly do it. It's going to hurt them if they keep doing it.
Exactly.
They go through it if we don't stop them all. They don't learn what stopping, no, is making.
Right.
They don't hurt themselves enough that they don't do that.
That's a good point. It's so maybe a disciplinary measure to teach them. That's wrong and it needs to be corrected.
But too, it's a matter of choice. They chose a commandment and broke the commandment. And God's righteous and those that are sinners, when you transgress, you broke that covenant relationship.
All right.
And
I think the point he's getting at, because really following the theme of Romans, when you see words like righteousness and justice, and even sin, they are legal terms to a certain degree. What is sin? What does John say sin is in 1 John 3 and verse 4?
Transgression.
Transgression, lawlessness. You have transgressed a law. Now, God is a righteous and holy, pure judge, isn't He? If that's the case, and the wages of sin is death, there are consequences to sin. Ultimately, it's death, spiritual death. We know physical death is included in that as well, but the spiritual death, and God is holy. Then when someone sins, it doesn't matter how much God loves them. To maintain His holy and pure nature, that sin has to be punished. That's the whole point of this gospel theme. That's the quandary we're in, where we don't know how to get out of this state. If God is holy and He's pure and He can't have fellowship with sin, so the wages of sin is death, we're separate from Him, and that's eternal death, then how in the world are we ever going to get to heaven if we have sin? How is that going to happen? How can God be just? We noted in our introduction in chapter 3 and verse 26, it says that He is just and the justifier. How? How can He not have us be dead eternally, eternally separated from Him, if we have indeed sinned? How's that going to happen? And so that's the point. Obviously, the answer is Jesus in Romans, and we'll note the specifics as to how that works out. But it's judicial, and we need to remember that. It's not emotional. And people will suggest that skeptics really will suggest that that's the problem they have with this idea of God. He's just flying off the handle, right? He is emotional. He's, you know, striking people dead and all of that kind of stuff. It's judicial. God is love is manifested in wrath, I think, in that way that Logan described. I think that was a good concept to get out there. But it's displayed in His willingness that, or His unwillingness that anyone should perish, but that all should come to repentance, right? 2 Peter 3 and verse 9. 1 Timothy 2, that all men should come to the knowledge of the truth to be saved, right? He wants all men to be saved, and His love is expressed in that. That's why we have the gospel, verses 16 and 17. But the gospel is necessary because God is just, and so sin must be executed or punished. Punishment must be executed, and that's where His wrath comes in. So His wrath is revealed. That's what has to be dealt with when sin comes around, and we walk through that door. But how can we escape the wrath of God? Chapter 5, that's a phrase that is used in verse 9 of Romans 5. Much more than having now been justified by His blood. We know that's how we escape it. We shall be saved from wrath through Him. If it was emotional wrath, none of us would stand a chance. We'd already be in hell burning for eternity. It wouldn't have even, you know, there wouldn't be long suffering if it was emotional. We see in James chapter 1 that the wrath of man does not exhibit or execute, exactly what it says, I forget, the righteousness of God, demonstrate the righteousness of God. James 1 in verse 20, the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. There's a difference between our wrath and the wrath of God. Someone does something to make us angry and we have an outburst of wrath. There's no control there. There's no thought there. It's just an impulse. That's not what God's wrath is. He doesn't fly off the handle. His wrath is actually so controlled that before sin ever occurred, and He knew it was going to occur, He made this plan of the gospel so that men could escape His wrath. But the fact of the matter that wrath had to be revealed so that people understood there's a problem here, and that problem is sin. So we need to remember that. That's a whole point. God's wrath is revealed not just to the Gentiles, but also to the Jews. And because of that, the gospel is necessary, and this is the gospel. And the gospel is not just needed for Gentiles, it's needed for Jews. So Jews, you got to be saved by the gospel every bit as much as the Gentiles. You can't be saved by the old law. Why? Because God's wrath is revealed even on you. And so that's important going through, remembering these judicial concepts, that this is not emotional with God. He certainly has emotions, but they're in control, and His wrath is certainly not emotional. It is very pointed and judicial.
When you look at our law, it has like promises for good, and then has those that are bad. The wrath of the law falls upon those who are disobedient to the law, break the law. And I mean, that's God's law too. But to be disobedient to the law here, then there's going to be a punishment for it.
Right. And along with that, we understand, like when Romans 6 says, you're no longer under law but under grace, that it's not suggesting that wrath is no more. The wrath of God is still even revealed in the gospel, because the wages of sin is still death. Now, the difference is there's a provision under the gospel for the forgiveness, right? All right, so let's get into that text a little deeper. He says, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things." We'll pause there. And so, ultimately, he's identifying who the wrath is revealed against. We know it's all man, but he's especially noting the Gentiles here. Notice there, it's against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. We've touched on ungodliness several times throughout different studies. We know that godliness is piety before God, reverence before God. And so, ungodliness is they have no respect or reverence before God. Now, unrighteousness is one of those legal terms, and it simply means an act that violates standards of right. Now, one thing we need to remember is that there's no ingrained moral law within man. He actually will talk about that in chapter 2. I think that it may be that I'm not understanding exactly what he explains, but I thought I saw a contradiction here before, because on page 17 he says at the top, "No, man has an innate sense of right and wrong, but if he turns against God, man can become insensible to a righteous standard." And then on page 27, he says we can't say that he has an innate moral sense of right and wrong. It's got to come from God, and there's got to be that law that is violated. We'll touch on that, I guess, when we get to chapter 2. But we've got to understand what that means. There is a standard of right conduct, and that man has now transgressed it, lawlessness, sinned against it. Why? Because he doesn't respect God. And so these two things go together. Ungodliness leads to unrighteousness. That simply means going against what is right according to a standard, and we know that standard is from God. He notes in the book too that a lot of times unrighteousness is shown to be that which is wrong before man in your relationship with man. So it's injustice, not dealing fairly with fellow man. That may be the case here. But I think, simply put, they didn't have God as a person they respected, and therefore they violated His law. And this is how they did it. The reason why that wrath is revealed is because what they mean known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them, that after they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. They know the truth. We'll note what the truth is. It's down here when he explains what may be known of God is shown to them, that are His invisible attributes, His eternal power, and His Godhead. So they knew those things, but they held it down. That's what suppressed means, in unrighteousness. And we see that throughout the world today. Men don't want to think about God, so they go deeper into their sin. They don't want to think about God. They don't want to have that feeling of being responsible before Him. So they're certainly not going to darken the door of a church building. They're going to stay away from that, and they're going to be engulfed in their sins. And that's where the hardening of the heart comes in, and the callousing of the conscience. Why did they know this? I want to point out also, though, when he says that it's revealed from heaven, the wrath, notice in verse 32, he says, "They know the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death." So the way it's revealed is through a demonstration of God. I think certainly it would be in the commands of God, like in Genesis chapter 2 that Russ mentioned. After he gave the law, he gave them the consequence. "Don't eat of this tree, for in the day you eat of it, you shall surely die." There is the wrath of God revealed, not in a realization, but in a warning. And then it's revealed when they did sin against God and eat of that tree, they were obviously dead spiritually, separated in their sin, but then physical death came into the world and they were excommunicated from the garden. That is something that through the teaching of families of human history would have been continually preserved. But then we see when Israel especially comes on the scene, after all of these things that are revealed in Genesis of the wrath of God, like Sodom and Gomorrah is something we might think of in Romans chapter 1 with homosexuality. That's a revelation of the wrath of God. And that was understood. People knew about Sodom and Gomorrah. People knew about the Israelites going and conquering disobedient and sinful nations. And their hearts melted in them like wax, is what Rahab says in Joshua chapter 1. Those are the things of the wrath of God. And that's one of the reasons why Pharaoh was raised up, we read in the Exodus account. That all the world can know who is God and the type of God He is. Doesn't deal with idolatry or sin. He doesn't mess with it. And that's why the Egyptians fell. Their hearts were hardened through their persistence in sin. And God's wrath was revealed against that. So I think that's a big part of this. We also see God's wrath revealed in the context of Romans chapter 1. Because they're going deeper and deeper into their sin. And like we see in verse 27, there's a penalty within themselves that's due, and people see that. We'll talk about what that is. But the wrath of God is certainly revealed. People can see it. And really, physical death is the greatest contributor to the revelation of God's wrath. The reason men die is because of God's wrath. Because He told Adam and Eve that you would surely die, and certainly physical death entered. We see in 1 Corinthians 15. I've kind of missed noting that. So we progress on to verse 20. So how is it evident among them? It's manifest. God has shown it to them. They have no excuse, we'll see at the end of verse 20. But notice He explains, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen. This is the truth of verse 18 that they've suppressed. And He'll explain what it is. Being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. In Psalm 19 and verse 1, we're familiar with that text that says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. And I think that sometimes we think of that as, look at the beauty of the stars. There must be a God. Certainly that's true. But even more so, you think deeper and more scientifically in the mathematics that are in the universe, the cosmos of order, and how we can literally set our clocks by it. And that's what Genesis 1 talks about. He made the stars to rule the night and the sun to rule the day. And by that created the seasons and the days and the months and the years. All of those kinds of things. And people who don't even believe in God acknowledge the order that's out there. And that's part of it. How can something so intricate and vast be in existence? Well, what the heavens do, what that creation makes evident, is that there is an eternal power behind this. And that shows us the nature of this power. And so, especially you think of life, people, you know, man create different things, and something they'll never be able to replicate is life. Why? Because God is life. He's the way that life exists. And so there's a power that's within man, even, that they can do a bunch of things. They can invent things. Technology has progressed. But it's not eternal power. They couldn't create all that we see. They couldn't create life. And that's what he's saying, that the creation evidences that there's a power that is greater than all that we see. It transcends time itself. It is eternal. And so you think about even making anything, you know, where do you get the materials to make things? Well, God created it. Everything that we see, all material that we see, it was coming from God. He created it. But it shows that He exists because at one time nothing was, and then all of a sudden everything was. And that's because He's eternal. He's not held down by time. He was before creation, and so He's not subject to creative law, which is why we see how foolish it is to be idolaters. Now, the only one that possesses that kind of power is divinity, is a God. And you can see that expressed in places like Acts 19 with the people in Athens. They knew that although all of these gods represented all of these parts of nature and stuff, that there must be some unknown God that created even everything else. There's that logic that progresses to it. There's got to be one that transcends all else. So what is manifest in creation, and they're without excuse about it, they know it, it's not that it's not clear to them, is that there is an eternal power behind all the order we see, And that eternal power is only possessed by one who is divinity. And that's what we see, theotes is that word, Godhead, the quality or characteristics pertaining to deity, divinity, divine nature, divineness. So creative creation boasts of creative power, which is only eternal in nature. And that's part of what we use in apologetics. That's what we turn to. The order of the universe and the uncaused cause of everything. And that's something that, you know, skeptics will try to hang us up on. Well, you know, if God created everything, who created God? We never, ever, ever suggest that God was created. That's the whole point. You can't explain anything. You go back to the Big Bang, but you recognize and agree to this difficulty of knowing where that little bit of matter came from in the first place that created everything. And that's something that they understand they have no answer for. And they say, maybe eventually it'll come up. We don't have it right now. Well, we've got the answer. And even the laws of nature and science that are demonstrated in textbooks and are studied in universities show a contradiction in their thought. There has to be a beginning. And that beginning, because you can't create something from nothing within the laws of nature, has to be outside those laws, which renders this concept of the eternal power in Godhead. Yes?
The difference between what man creates and God created. God took nothing and made everything.
Right.
And they take what God made and make something.
Exactly. And that's the foolishness of idolatry. So I'm going to make a God, but I'm going to take what the one and only true God gave me, make that image, and I'm going to worship what I made instead of what I made worshiping me. And it's just completely foolish. And that's why it says it was done out of the futility of their thoughts. When you put God out of the picture, thinking goes bizarre. It doesn't, nothing makes sense. And that's the point. That's part of the wrath of God. If you want to go there, God says, I'll let you go there, and you'll see how depraved and corrupt and twisted and perverted man can get. Now, those are things that are without an excuse. They know it. And it shows how they suppressed the truth and unrighteousness. He says in verse 21, because although they knew God, they didn't glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. So they knew God, but they didn't glorify Him. What it means to glorify God is ultimately what Jesus said in John 17 and verse 4. He says this, it's a good example. He came to glorify God. He said, I have glorified you, John 17 and verse 4, on the earth. How? I have finished the work which you have given me to do. We glorify our Creator by doing what we've been created to do. And I think we can understand that. When someone invents something, they don't receive any kind of glory or honor or praise if what they invented didn't do what it was invented to do. That's called a failure. And they may go on and eventually figure out how it actually works, but that's called a failure. I don't receive any honor or praise from something I made that doesn't even work. And so that's a concept. How do we glorify God? Well, they would have to search Him out to know His law. But Solomon shows us in Ecclesiastes 12:13 that the whole purpose of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. And so when they knew that God existed, what Paul is saying is the next step, and man knows this, it's logical, is to seek Him. And that's what Acts 17 says God created us for, to seek Him out in hopes that we might grope for Him and find Him. He's not far from each one of us. But they didn't glorify Him, and they weren't thankful. So if they recognize the eternal power in Godhead in creation, then all the things they have that are essentials, they should be thanking God about. But they didn't thank Him. And that progresses further into the futility of their thoughts. If they're not willing to glorify God, if they're not thankful for God and He's out of the picture, then where are they left? Foolish thoughts. The fool has said in their heart, there is no God. And then in Proverbs 1 and verse 7, though, it says that the beginning, or the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. So if you're not willing to acknowledge God, nothing else is going to make sense. They didn't want to acknowledge God ultimately because they wanted to do what they wanted to do. That's evident. If they didn't want to do what they wanted to do, but what God wanted them to do, that would be called obeying Him and glorifying Him. But they didn't do that. And so when you leave God out of the picture, then any of your thinking becomes foolish because God is the origin of your thought. And so if you take Him out of the picture, what's the standard? Where do you have to go on? What do you have to consider? And because of that, their foolish hearts were darkened. They had foolish hearts, and that led to the darkness of ignorance. Oftentimes in Scripture, that's what darkness has a reference to. If we're not going to acknowledge God, we'll show ourselves to be fools. And because not acknowledging God will lead to a lack of knowledge, we're going to become more and more ignorant. And so you have all of these moral issues in politics and these questions of when does life begin and all of those kinds of silly things. And it's because God's not in the picture. When God's not in the picture, there's no basis of morality or thoughts to go on. And, you know, it's up to anyone's determination. And that's why some think that it's okay to execute a baby when he's outside of the womb. That's unheard of, but now it is heard of. And that's because society is secularized. It's interesting, in Matthew 13, the parable of the sower, when he's explaining why he speaks to the people in parables, he tells the apostles, "For whoever has, to him more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him." That's especially pertinent in the context of the Jews. They knew things about God. They knew things about the Messiah. But what they thought they had when they decided they didn't like Jesus as the Messiah was even taken away from them. And so they progressed in their ignorance. And when these people who knew God existed now failed to seek Him out as He wanted to be found, and they would have found Him, Matthew 7, "Seek and you will find," then they started having all of these crazy thoughts about who God must be. And that's where idolatry comes from. God can't come from our minds because God happened before our minds. But if we reject the God who is eternal, eternal power and Godhead, then He's going to start becoming more and more like us. That's how you get the concepts of Greek mythology and that kind of wrath, where they actually want to hurt and punish mankind and reign as despots over them and all of that kind of stuff. And it shows an ignorance about what a divine nature actually is. He progresses in this, how they suppress the truth and unrighteousness and how their foolish hearts were darkened. This is where they got to. Professing to be wise, they became fools. So they're professing to be wise without the fear of God, and where there is no God in your minds, that wisdom is not wisdom at all. 1 Corinthians 3 says, if you want to be wise, become a fool that you may become wise. And it means forget all that you know, essentially, and accept God's wisdom as the true wisdom. So professing to be wise, they became fools, and this is what they did. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God. They saw He was incorruptible, His eternal power and God has revealed in nature. They didn't want to seek Him out as He is. And so they changed that incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. And we see the vast ignorance and futility, the foolishness of that in the Old Testament displayed. One example is seen in Habakkuk chapter 2. Habakkuk chapter 2. Remember in verse 17, "The just shall live by faith." That's actually quoted from Habakkuk chapter 2. But notice in Habakkuk 2 and verse 18, he basically mocks idolatry, but he says, "What profit is the image that its maker should carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all." Idolatry is just completely and totally foolish. And that's where we get to when we're not thinking about God. Here's something that I create out of the material universe, and I create that, and I create it out of inanimate objects, and then I start bowing down to what I've created and acting like something that I've created is responsible for all of these vast, wonderful, crazy, intricate designs that I see in nature. Now, how foolish is that? Who would ever suggest that that's how it came about? No one in their right mind, but we can't be in our right mind if we refuse to acknowledge God. That's how they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And the reason why they would do that is because when they create the God and it came from their mind, they're going to be able to decide how that God is served. Which is why in so many different pagan religions, the way you served their god was committing sexual immorality. So like the church in Ephesus was surrounded by idol worshippers with the great goddess of Diana and her temple in Ephesus, where there were priestesses who were actual prostitutes that waited outside the temple doors, because that's how you serve that god. And several other gods are served in that same way. And that's really the whole point of this. Why was idolatry ever created? Well, it's because people want to do what people want to do, and so they're going to create a god. They know there's a god in existence that they're supposed to be submitting to, but they don't like his laws. They don't like his nature. And so they're going to create their own god, ultimately to ease their conscience, and they get to do what they want to do. Now, that's not seen in today's time in that same way. We don't really, I mean, in Eastern religions, we still see it somewhat, but really in higher civilized countries like the one we live in, Western culture, where science really reigns and intellectualism is the end-all be-all to existence, you don't really see those things. Why? Because it's obviously foolish. How can you say that that little image that you carved yourself made everything? That's ridiculous. Now, it's different with claiming that there is a true, almighty, powerful, eternal God that is not seen in all of these things insofar as being made with hands, like Acts 17 says. That's logical, but it's not logical to say this little golden idol made all of these things. So what becomes the idol? Education. Ourselves. That's where humanism comes about. So what do we do if we see that God exists in creation? That's the only explanation to order, is one who created that order. That's the only explanation to design, is a designer. Well, what do you do if you don't want to know what that God actually wants you to do, for fear it might mean you've got to stop doing what you're doing, that you like doing, sinning? What do you do? Well, I'm not going to stoop down to these Eastern religions where I'm bowing down to this block of marble or wood or clay or whatever it may be. I'll just say there is no God. And man is at the top of the food chain. That's where we are in this culture, humanism. And really, we become the idols we serve. Notice he says there, they change him into an image made like corruptible man. And that is exactly what we are. How can we, who definitely have an end to our life on this earth and will return to the dust, how can we be it when everything else exists? It's completely foolish. And we not need to always remember that we're on the side of reason. We're on the side of logic. We're on the side of enlightenment, because we know the truth that God has revealed to us. Everything else is truly foolish.
You look at today, though, they have a God, it's a pleasure today.
Yep.
And that includes offering up the children to the babies, unborn babies, sacrificing them to the God, it's a pleasure.
Right.
Because they don't want to raise them.
Exactly.
But
that's a super depraved example of it, like some of the examples we'll see in the rest of the chapter. Without God there, we can do whatever we want, and that's the whole point. Get God out of the picture, and we can do what we want. And it's ultimately obvious throughout the world and throughout history, especially biblically, but even recorded in secular senses, that there are consequences to these things. Now, what he'll do is he'll have essentially three sections, as we see right there. God gave them up. And so the whole point of what we just studied, and it took longer than I thought, so we'll be on chapter 1 next time, but the whole point of what we studied is that it's obvious God exists, but because they didn't care about him, they started doing what they wanted, and to ease their consciences, they made their own gods, which was completely and totally foolish. It contradicts all the things that they actually can observe in creation. That's why the wrath of God is revealed. And this is kind of part of the wrath of God. Certainly it's revealed in history. We know that God destroyed evil nations. We know that that exists. And the very understanding of physical death, which we see really in verse 32, those who practice such things are deserving of death. That's why men die. That's revealed. But also, if we want to go there, God's going to let us go there. God's going to let us see how bad things can really get. So he goes through three sections. Firstly, God gives them up to uncleanness. And I think that's more of a general consideration. It's unclean. It's something they initially wanted, They know that God is holy. They know that God is pure. They know that God wants us to follow His will, but so they can do what they want, they're going to get Him out of their minds and do what they want. They want unclean things. It says that the uncleanness He gave them up to is in the lust of their hearts. They had an immense desire to do those things. And God said, if you want to do them, I can't do anything about it because I created with you free will, and I'm going to let you go do it. That doesn't mean that He's necessarily permitting it. It's okay to do it, but He's going to, I'll let you do what you want to do, and you'll see how bad it can get. And it expounds upon that in verse 26 with vile passions. It's uncleanness. Well, what specifically is that? He kind of alludes to it. They dishonor their bodies. They dishonor their bodies through homosexuality is what he mentions. And then down in verse 28, it talks about he gave them over to a debased mind. It's a worthless mind, which is what we described before. If God's not in the picture, then your mind's worthless because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And that's going to open up to all of these other kinds of sins. So there's a rapid decline in these kinds of areas, and there are penalties with those things, which is the wrath of God that's being revealed. We'll pick up there again next Wednesday.